All right, our next case for argument is 21-1744, Polycom versus Direct Packet Research. Mr. Eaton, please proceed when you're ready.
Morning again, Your Honors. I feel like I'm about to embark on the second of two back-to-back marathons. Second one may be tiring. Your Honors, the board found all the claims of the 978 patent invalid as obvious, other than those that were disclaimed once they were faced with an allegation of obviousness, except two classes of claims, the alternate data claims and the network registration claims. I'm going to talk just for a minute about kind of the claimed invention in general and then explain why the board was wrong to uphold those particular aspects of the claim while rejecting the others. So the basic invention is the method of traversing a firewall by taking multi-port packets, converting them to single-port packets, routing them through a predetermined port, and then sort of demultiplexing them and putting, or remultiplexing them, I guess, and putting them back into their multi-port form through the open port. All of the claims are variations on that theme. The basic invention is undisputedly obvious. Direct Packet immediately disclaimed it along with like half the other claims over Krtolica and Kirchhoff. Let's start with the network registration claims. There's no dispute that all the elements of the network registration claims are present in the prior art. The board found as much. It's not disputed here. The only basis for the board's determination that those claims are not obvious was its conclusion that Polycom failed to prove that a person of ordinary skill would have a motivation to combine those aspects of the art references. It said first that because the network registration function in Kirchhoff sits on an external manager that's outside the firewall, it wouldn't be useful in the Krtolica reference, because there, the communications are established using an adapter controller that's inside the firewall. And the board seemed to discount the disclosure of network registration in Kirchhoff for that reason. And it also relatedly said that Polycom failed to show that network registration would improve Krtolica. To get to that conclusion, Your Honor, that the board applied an analysis of the motivation to combine test that was unduly narrow by focusing on the location of Kirchhoff's network registration claims rather than the function. It never really considered, at least didn't consider sufficiently, whether a person of ordinary skill in the art would add the functionality of network registration. We don't dispute that you wouldn't add an external manager to Krtolica. It wouldn't make sense. That was never the argument. The argument was always you would add network registration because it enables packet filtering, which will enable you to allow more traffic through the firewall in a secure way, which is the stated function of Krtolica. Specifically, it's intended to route communications through network firewalls with minimal security risk. That's what network registration does. Krtolica explains that sort of the problem it's solving is that multimedia communications through firewalls are problematic for a variety of reasons, and the original method of dealing with that was to drop the firewall or reduce its effectiveness. And they're trying to solve that problem by directing the multimedia through a single port. So you don't have to lower the firewall, you just have to direct it all through a single port. Through a single port in the firewall. Network registration is a method of trusted communication, right? You've registered your endpoint with me. I know you're a trusted communicator. I will accept content from you. There is no reason why that wouldn't be a useful addition to Krtolica. Remember, Krtolica is solving a particular part of the firewall problem. It says, I'm going to enable multimedia communication through this single port. It's a way to prevent data loss on the way through the firewall, but it's not a panacea for the security that Krtolica is trying to achieve. right? It screens certain kinds of content, but not others. There may be other security risks that packet filtering via network registration could mitigate. And the board did not seem to consider that possibility when it rejected this aspect of the of our argument below. It's essentially the same rationale that was used to add encryption to Cryptolica, which put in a different aspect of the board's opinion. And the board didn't seem to have a problem with it there, but for some reason decided that essentially the same motivation, which is improving security within the network behind the firewall, that made adding encryption obvious, did not make adding network registration obvious, and that was error.
What I thought that you said the board had made a legal error in its utilization of the motivation to combine. What was the legal error?
The legal error, Your Honor, was focusing, instead of focusing on the function of network registration, which was in fact what we argued, basically saying, well, it's external to the firewall, which you wouldn't make, it wouldn't be compatible, essentially, with Cryptolica because its structure is different. But that's not the appropriate consideration. The appropriate consideration is it doesn't matter whether you can physically combine Cryptolica and Kirchhoff. It matters whether Opposa would think of this functionality as being appropriate for Cryptolica. The board seems to have put undue weight on the location of the external manager in Kirchhoff, and I think that was legal error, Your Honor. The argument is also, we have an alternative argument that conclusion is not supported by substantial evidence. I think you can go either way. I think the record is sufficient on both. Your Honors, on the alternate data claims, the board said that Polycom failed to provide sufficient evidence that the combination of Cryptolica and Kirchhoff teaches the claim limitation and failed to explain how incompatible TCP and UDP protocols could communicate with each other in order to teach the alternate data in response to a resend request limitation.
Well, the board started by finding that you waived this argument, didn't it?
Well, they said it was a new argument. They didn't actually find that we waived it. The word waiver doesn't appear. Our opponents didn't argue waiver. They entertained the argument, and the opponents got a cert reply. So there's not really a good basis for finding a waiver in those circumstances, Your Honor, as we explained in our brief. The argument was fully considered. In ordinary circumstances, if there were no cert reply, you know, then perhaps there's an argument. But they were able to address the argument, and the board was able to address the argument. So from a
patent owner argues that petitioner impermissibly presents a new argument in its reply, and we agree.
Well,
that feels, you're right, they didn't use the word waiver.
No,
but
they didn't.
That,
I think that
feels
matters.
Like a synonym.
Forfeiture.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, the
well
waiver forfeiture debate. No, Your Honor. Yes, it found that we impermissibly presented the argument. I agree. It didn't expressly find that we waived it, which would be a legal conclusion that it would have to reach in its discretion. Then it considered the argument, which it would not have been required to do if it had found that we waived it.
Well, but after it says patent owner argues petitioner impermissibly presents a new argument in its reply and we agree, it then says even if we were to consider petitioner's new argument, that does seem that even if we were to consider seems to suggest that they're saying we hold we don't have to consider, but even if we were to consider it, they would still lose. But that even if we were to consider language sort of reinforces to me their conclusion initially is that they are not going to decide the issue. And then they did what they do often with us, which, by the way, is very good, is give us an alternative analysis in the event that it has to be reached. So I guess I do read their opinion as concluding that they're not going to and don't have to address your argument because it was impermissibly raised for the first time in the reply. But then they go on and do it alternatively. But is that an unfair reading on my part?
No, Your Honor, your point is well taken. You can read that language that way. The fact remains that they did consider the argument. The ordinary procedure before the board is if someone raises an argument impermissibly in reply is you move to strike the reply. That's normally how it's handled. They didn't do that. They actually didn't even say we impermissibly raised it. They just said it was new. The board kind of put that gloss on it. So, Your Honor, I think given that the argument was raised, they didn't say that we waived it. The board didn't expressly find that we waived it, although I understand that you could read the language that way. The board addressed it. The other side had an opportunity to address it in full. there's really not a good reason. You know, the law abhors a forfeiture, Your Honor. There's not a good reason from a judicial point of view to find a waiver in those circumstances. So to return to the merits of the argument, so this notion that we fail to explain how incompatible TCP and UDP embodiments could communicate with each other, the board found in a variety of contexts that allowing incompatible protocols to communicate via conversion was obvious. It doesn't explain why it's not obvious in this circumstance, which doesn't make a great deal of sense. The board found Claim 6 obvious over Cretologa's teaching of the use of both TCP and UDP in the same communication system, where they're both multi-port packets, they get converted together into single-port packets, reconverted and delivered. Those being in the same stream, those must be going between points that can speak to each other. And given that the patent itself nowhere explains how this is done, it doesn't explain how alternate data is ever sent. So it's actually improper to require us to show what the patent itself does not explain. As the court said last year in the Uber Technologies case, you know, where the specification is entirely silent on how to transmit or how to transmit user locations and maps from a server, blah blah blah, suggesting that a person of ordinary skill in the art was more than capable of doing so. So here you have a patent that has one sentence that talks about sending alternate data in return in response to a resend request. Never explains how it's done. In those circumstances, it suggests, according to this court's precedent, that it would have been obvious for an artisan to do that. I mean, I suppose in other contexts, it might mean that there's insufficient support in the spec for the claim, but that's not what we're talking about here. In these circumstances, the appropriate conclusion is that a POSA would have known how to do it. And in those circumstances, the claim would have been obvious.
Would you like to save your rebuttal
time?
Yes,
I'll save my remaining couple minutes. Thank you.
Hey, please the court, Mr. Ross, again, this time for the appellee, the patent owner, DPR. I'd like to start by talking about the subset of claims 8, 19, and 27, which was the last grouping that appellant talked about. And this has to do with the waiver issue, or forfeiture, if you want to call it that. What has gone unstated is that the rule by which this is done is 37 CFR section 42.23B. This court has held that in reviewing a determination by the board under 42.23B, it is reviewed for an abuse of discretion and not merely substantial evidence. And on this record, I don't see how we can say that there was an abuse of discretion. But at the very outset, this court has another issue that it has to decide. This whole question of whether or not 37 CFR 42.23B was complied with was not even raised in the opening brief by Polycom. They drop a passing footnote not mentioning that, but as the court knows, this precedent, this court has repeatedly said, arguments only raised in a footnote are waived. That's the Ford Motor Company versus United States case, amongst others. And significantly, nowhere in the opening brief does Polycom argue that the board committed an abuse of discretion. It doesn't even do that in the reply brief. So this court has to first decide whether or not this entire line of argument is even properly before it on appeal. And we would submit that it's not. If the court does decide that that issue is properly before the court, I would submit that the board below did not commit an abuse of discretion. The argument made in the response to our first response at the board was clearly a new argument. Their initial position was only UDP is being considered in the petition. They then say, uh-oh, we're going to be dead wrong on that, so we now got to say UDP and TCP should be considered subsequently. But this court in its Henny Penny case said, quote, it is of the utmost importance that petitioners in the IPR proceedings identify with particularity the evidence that supports the grounds for the challenge for each claim in the petition. They did not identify this TCP argument in the petition, certainly without any particularity. And therefore, the board was completely right to say that it was a new argument, and it was completely within its discretion to say, we're not going to listen to that new argument. And that's not a function of whether or not we get a reply brief. It's not a function of whether there's any fairness or non-fairness. The question is not the same as with a waiver in a district court, because here a regulation controls. The question is, did they comply with the regulation? And they clearly did not. The board found they did not. And I don't think this court can substitute its judgment for the board. So it's not a question of whether or not there was an opportunity to consider the argument. The question is, did they comply with the regulation? They did not. They admit they did not. And therefore, that argument was impermissible and within the discretion of the board to refuse to hear. And I don't think this court should substitute its judgment on that. Now, even if you were to turn to the issue on the merits, the argument being made today is that it would still work under UDP-TCP hybrid embodiment, not mentioned in the petition, because of this conversion concept. Well, guess what? That conversion argument was not raised in their opening brief to this court, and therefore it is forfeited as well, leaving them with nothing even on the merits with respect to this subset of claims surrounding Claim 8. Now, let me turn briefly, if I may, to the second subset of claims at issue here. This is claims 9, 20, and 28. And here, the standard of review is substantial evidence. First of all, every argument you saw in the briefs on this point, every argument just made by counsel here, was made to the board. There's no new evidence being pointed to here, no new arguments being made. All they are doing is asking you to substitute your judgment on the evidence of the record for the judgment of the board. And I would submit that that's not the proper approach on appeal here. Now, Your Honor asked a question about identifying the legal error, and you noticed there was some lag time in getting an answer. Now, that's because there was no legal error here. The issue, there was no test. The reference was made, well, they got the test wrong or the test was too narrow. There was no test applied here. The board listened to and reviewed all the evidence and all the arguments submitted by appellant and did not credit them. They found them either not factually accurate or else simply said that does not meet your burden before the board to prove by preponderance of the evidence that it is obvious. That's all the board did below. It did not engage in some sort of new legal precedent establishment or establish some sort of new test or apply the test. It simply said you did not meet your burden. And that is a substantial evidence review. It did not also give undue weight to any particular set of facts. It simply said in every instance, you know, we just don't think you're establishing. You're not meeting your burden of proof here. We're listening to all the arguments. We're looking at all the evidence you're presenting. It simply doesn't get you there. That's not some sort of legal error. That's not some sort of new legal test. It's not something that's reviewed de novo by this court. And we think the board clearly had substantial evidence for reaching the conclusions that it reached. And, Your Honor, unless there are any questions on any of this, that's all I have. We'll rest on our argument today and argument in the briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. Mr. Eaton, you have some rebuttal time.
Your Honor, I'll be very brief. I would just point out that when the two arguments that the other side raises are, well, if you didn't raise it below, it's waived, and if you did raise it below, you lose, I think we're overlooking what the judicial process is. They haven't actually responded to any of the arguments that we made in this court today on the data registration claims. So I would put it to you, Your Honor, that they have essentially nothing to say in response to those. It's simply relying on the board's judgment is not sufficient. The Georgia board's judgment is subject to this court's review, and they haven't responded to it.
Counsel, in situations involving forfeiture, our court has said repeatedly that we still have the discretion to hear the issues if they were fully briefed.
Yes.
And in this case, that seems to be the case. Why couldn't we just go ahead and hear that and rule on the board's finding, alternative finding?
You could, Your Honor, and that is part of our position here with respect to the alternate data claims. Remember, the data registration claims, there is no waiver argument. If Your Honors don't have further questions for me, I'll retire.
Okay, thank you. I thank both counsel. This case is taken under submission.